From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For a long time now, this spectacle has been playing out in the northern Utah town of Wellsville. As part of the Founders Day celebration, right after the parade, people gather at an elementary school baseball field and they watch people act out this battle between Mormon settlers and Shoshone Indians. The actors playing the Indians are white guys on horseback with bandanas and feather headdresses, and their bodies are painted red. Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke wasn't the first one to notice this battle was more than just a little insensitive, but he was one of the first to write about it. So he's joining us today as we talk about this long history of playing Indian in this country. We've done this a lot. Join us after the news. Hi, it's Doug Fabrizio, and if you can join us for the next screening in our documentary series, you're in for a treat. This is our partnership with Utah Film Center. Wednesday night, we're showing you Tomer Hayman's acclaimed documentary about the Israeli choreographer Ohad Naharin. The film is called Mr. Gaga. It's getting a lot of critical acclaim. And as part of the evening, Repertory Dance Theater will be performing. So make sure you come to the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center Wednesday night at 7. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. On September 4th, Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke headed to Wellsville, Utah for the city's annual Founders Day celebration. He had heard about a tradition that had been going on for years and years, this reenactment of a mock Indian attack on Mormon settlers. Apparently, these kinds of things used to be pretty common. They were called sham battles, and they usually involved wagons and a burning building and always white men dressed up as Indians. And sure enough, Gerke saw the Wellsville version. He wrote a column about it, made a video about how, as he put it, this handful of folks from town painted their bodies crimson red and slathered on war paint to reenact a clash that didn't really happen, or certainly not quite in that way. Today in the program, we're talking about the Wellsville sham battle and the long history we have in this country of playing Indian. We'll begin with Robert Gerke. I guess, first of all, I'm trying to figure out how it is that this thing had been happening for a lot of years, and no one really paid all that much attention to it until you did.
Right. Well, it has been going on. I mean, I actually came across a newspaper article from the Logan paper that talked about sham battles being held in the 19-teens, you know. So this is something that goes way back. I heard about it from friends that live up in Wellsville. I heard about it a couple years ago, actually. And it was something that always kind of piqued my interest, but I didn't get up there to report on it. As a columnist, I decided that, you know, it was something that I wanted to check out. And, you know, I had been told that it was kind of offensive. Yeah. And so I went up there and to see it with my own eyes. And it was just exactly as it was billed, you know, the spectacle of people with this red paint and rolling on the ground and riding horses and firing guns and things like that, whooping and hollering like they were acting like they think Indians act, I guess. And so it was a little bit shocking to me to see it with my own eyes.
It seems like when you look at the video that you shot, there's something really beyond the offensive part for a lot of people. There's something kind of charming or super old-fashioned about it, that you have these, it's a Founders Day celebration, and you have this, I don't know if it's canned audio or if there's actually somebody reading from this script. It seems like something out of the kind of the 50s or the 60s.
Well, it is, and you know, we have a tradition of this in our state, I think, that we honor or revere our pioneer heritage. Yeah. And there are similar celebrations all across the state, you know, Founders Day celebrations, Days of 47, parades, rodeo, things like that. You know, they honor their history and they should. I think that there's something valuable in that. I think where I personally run into problems with it, and where I think a lot of other people have, is is when they start diminishing other people's history, or at least soft selling the some of the messier parts of it. You know, the relationships with the Shoshone Indians up there, who were there first, were not always pleasant. I mean, there were squabbles, skirmishes, you know, theft on both sides. It was messy. There's no question about it. And I think what mostly troubled me was that they kind of gloss over the culmination of that at the battle of, they call it the Battle of Bear River. It's the Bear River Massacre, as commonly known now, where hundreds of Shoshone were killed by the soldiers, by the Union soldiers.
Mercilessly, brutally.
And then, just slaughtered. It was, you know, women had their heads bashed in. Infants were grabbed by their heels and smashed against rocks. They burned the lodges they had. They stole the grain. It was a massacre, and it was the bloodiest massacre of the American West. There's no question about it. And to sort of just pretend or to make a passing reference to it as if it was something that was just another ordinary deal was, I thought, was a little troubling.
So what was it like? It was interesting to hear the script, the narration for it. You heard things like Medicine Man and Braves and Fire Stick. I didn't hear Squaw.
No, there.
but it seemed pretty dated. The language.
It is a little bit the Fire Stick, the Braves hiding behind the foliage and behind trees and sort of scouting out these Mormon pioneers. It was very intensive on sort of the perseverance of the Mormons in spite of what they were up against. They stayed. They were going to stay. They stuck it out. Even though the Indians were kidnapping their children, they were going to stick it out and they were going to stay and make it work. So that was clearly being emphasized in it. It's interesting because it starts with the parade. They have the Founders Day parade, right. And at the end of the parade, bringing up the rear are these natives on horseback, these quote unquote natives, right?
There weren't any actual natives.
No, there were no actual natives. I saw no actual natives there. They come up on horseback and they're painted bright red. They have the war paint on and headdresses and are firing guns into the air, and they have their children with them sometimes. Whooping and so then they bring up the end of the parade and then proceed to the ball field where they have the teepee set up, this little makeshift cabin that they end up burning to sort of represent the Indians burning the village. Yeah. The teepee doesn't actually, nothing happens to the teepee. It's all the Indian aggression directed at the settlers. But then it just sort of evolves from there. As you mentioned, the narration is sort of walks people through the settlement of the Cache Valley.
Their version
of the settlement of the Cache Valley. Yeah,
I wondered about there were a lot of people there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems like I wouldn't say the whole town, but it looked like it was reasonably well attended. And I'm wondering if you got a sense of whether the people there in the town thought this was great or like they were a little weirded out by it at all. I mean, what do you have a sense of that?
No, everybody brought their kids. Their kids were really excited about it. It was clearly an annual tradition for many of them. You overheard conversations talking about last year's sham battle or the year before or how long they've been doing this. There were enough people there to basically ring in the entire baseball field, with two or three or four deep. People. And so it was a good crowd. It was well attended. I have heard, since I wrote the column from a number of people in Wellsville, I would say dozens of people in Wellsville who said, they would never go to the sham battle. They live there. They've objected to it for a long time, but they just chose to stay home instead of attending or making a big deal of it.
City leaders have said, look, what are you talking about? It has nothing to do with the Bear River Massacre. That's not really related.
That's kind of the point, right? I mean, it does have to do with the Bear River Massacre, whether they say it does or not. That is how the settlement of the Cache Valley was enabled. It ended the disputes between the Shoshone and the settlers. You can't tell the story without telling the story of the Bear River Massacre. It was a vital part of it. It's like trying to tell the story of America without talking about the Civil War, you can't gloss over that. I think the point is that they don't tell the whole story. And, the city leaders have said that, this is a tradition, it's a beloved tradition. And I get that. I think as we mentioned before, communities all across the state have these beloved traditions. And they say it doesn't represent a specific fight is more about training that the troops would do, you know, to sort of prepare for Indian attacks. But I don't think we've had an Indian attack in the Cache Valley in a long, long time. So we aren't doing this for preparation anymore. It's now a recreation or reenactment, and I think it's tone deaf the way they're doing it now.
When you write about it, when you've been writing about it, one of the things you say is you kind of draw this direct connection to this ongoing battle going on in the South over mm-hmm. these Confederate monuments. People, as you put it, trying to gloss over something out of a reverence for a past that in some ways didn't really exist. So in some ways, this is very similar to that, you see.
I think it is. And I think it's maybe a little bit more egregious in that this is an active participant event, right? This is not
a bronze statue.
This is not a bronze statue that we put up 50 or 100 years ago. You know, this is something that people are actively engaging in now, and probably represents something, you know, equally as troubling in our nation's past.
So I wonder what kind of reaction are you getting to the story? I mean, this thing took off.
It did. It did a little, probably more so than I expected it to. The reaction, I think, has been overwhelmingly supportive, as I mentioned, both from people in Wellsville and people from all across the state. Tribal leaders from several organizations have reached out to thank me for it. And, you know, as you might expect, the people in Wellsville, a lot of the people in Wellsville are not happy about it.
Yeah.
But I think what's important, as much as anything, is that in Cache Valley, in Wellsville in particular, we're now talking about it, right? So we, you know, if they want to continue doing this, I guess that's their prerogative to do. But at least we're having a discussion about it now.
I know some of the representatives from at least the Northwest Band of the Shoshone Nation, and maybe even others, they've been talking to city leaders,
mm-hmm.
and they're hoping to find some way to come to some sort of compromise. I can't tell what kind of compromise you could make out of that, though. Could you?
Well, I think you could. I mean, I don't think you necessarily can keep the sham battle in its current formation. But look, the sham battle is just part of their Founders Day celebration.
Right.
They have this rodeo. They have the parade. They have bounce houses. They have a fair. They have all of these things.
Yeah.
And if you want to do something that sort of refers to the settlement of the valley, instead of doing this fake sham battle, why don't you incorporate the Northwest Band, invite them in to kind of tell their part of the story too, and then you can get a more complete picture. One of the things that was troubling for me was watching the sham battle with all these children around, and it through their eyes, they see this as, you know, history. They see this as the way it actually happened. Well, why don't, if you incorporate the natives into this sort of telling of the story, then you can get a more complete picture. They can understand it better. They can understand nuance. And I think that's better for everybody. And you know, it honors the traditions as they actually are, not as they are, as we might like them to be.
So, which leads me to this finally. What kind of conclusions did you draw about, you know, how any community
mm-hmm.
celebrates on one hand a part of their history, but also acknowledges, you know, the uglier stuff, the messier stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell. As I mentioned in the column, if you do include the Bear River Massacre, it's not nearly as family friendly of an event.
Yeah.
And so it's a little bit harder to tell, but I think it's essential that we do that. I mean, I think that's and sort of harkening back, I guess, to the statues that we talked about, the Civil War statues. Part of the problem with those is that they elevate individuals, Robert E. Lee or Stonewall Jackson, at the expense of telling the broader story or the complexity of the story. And so I think it is possible for people in Wellsville to both honor their heritage, respect their roots and honor those roots, and still sort of acknowledge that it wasn't a simple cowboys and Indians play, that they're acting it out as having been.
Is it racist or just clumsy and insensitive?
I don't think, you know, I tried to be really careful not to call them racist because
yeah.
I don't think the people in Wellsville have bad intent, right? I think they just, this is something that they've always been doing. And they continue to do it without really questioning, you know, the propriety of it. You know, the people make the comparison between, you know, we don't do blackface anymore. Why are we doing, quote, redface? And I think that's valid in a number of respects. But I don't think they were mean spirited about it. I don't think they have any ill will towards the Shoshone Indians who are, live up in that area. I just think that it was maybe not well thought out and maybe a little tone deaf.
It's Robert Gerke. He's a columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about this tendency we've had as a country for white people to dress up like Indians. The reason we're discussing this is Robert Gerke's column in the Salt Lake Tribune about the recent Wellsville, Utah Founders Day celebration, which included this mock battle between Mormon settlers and Shoshone Indians. And as you've heard by now, the Indians were played by white guys who had painted their bodies red. Joining us now on the program is Philip DeLoria. He's a professor of American culture and history at the University of Michigan. He's also an enrolled member of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, and he's the author of several books about Native American history. He joined us from his home in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I guess I wanted to begin with your reaction to this Utah story that got us thinking about all of this in the first place, the case of basically playing Indian in Wellsville, where, you know, for 99 years now, as it turns out, as part of their Founders Day festivities, they have this fake fight between cowboys and Indians, you know, the Shoshone and the Mormon settlers. And, of course, the ones playing the parts of Indians dress up in red body paint. Just your general reaction to that. When you heard about that story and have looked at that story, what does it mean, that story, as you see it?
Well, I think it goes to a really deep kind of structure of American thinking about what it is to be American, about what it means to move into a new continent, to settle in that place, to displace the people who are there, and then, you know, in some ways to kind of claim the identity of those people. Which is a long tradition in American culture. What's interesting, you know, about Wellsville in some ways is it's partly that, but it's also partly, I think, this sort of desire to perform and commemorate history through performative kind of things. It has some resemblance to Civil War reenactors or fur trade reenactors, who want to internalize a kind of history, make meaning out of it for themselves by performing it. And that's interesting to me in the sense that it gives them meaning themselves, but there's also an audience for whom meaning is also being constructed.
Well, let's go back to kind of the first example, at least in American history, or one of them, of performing, dressing up like Indians. This is 1773, the Boston Tea Party. And it's basically, as you explain it in your book, it's street theater, it's civil disobedience, and it's orchestrated, it's organized. These are actors playing roles. So I want to ask about that, because here's the question you ask in the book. Why did that story of these colonists disguised as Indians take such a powerful hold on American imagination?
Yeah, exactly. Because it's just a weird little story, and you could frame it in many other kinds of ways. And yet it's taught to elementary school kids. We all know the story of the Boston Tea Party. I think it's a kind of convergence of a whole bunch of stuff. So on the one hand, there is the kind of performative street theater riots. These were, you know, the North and the South gangs of Boston, you know, were part of a whole kind of revolutionary street culture, which was being mobilized in for political kinds of terms. But there's also a big, long tradition of European cultural things that have to do with kind of rituals of inversion, of men dressing as women, for example, to go out and enact civil disobedience, of the charivari or the festivals of misrule, where, you know, the lowest is elevated to the highest. These things oftentimes involve performance and disguise and those kinds of things. So that collides, I think, with this question that colonists face at the moment of the revolution, which is, how do we stop being British? How do we stop being British colonists and imagine a new identity for ourselves as Americans in a way that's productive and, you know, that's good, that feels good? And I think the way that they do it is by looking to Indians as a kind of sign and a symbol of what it is to be Aboriginal or indigenous to the continent. They make an argument that they are the inhabitants of this place, and that's an argument that's framed relative to the British Empire.
Yeah.
So it becomes very powerful symbolically, and then it has the power of performance behind it. It's got a whole set of cultural meanings, and it's got political street theater going on at once.
It's so interesting. You write about the fact that those colonists and maybe even Americans throughout history, we've wanted our cake and we want to eat it too. In the sense that for the way we saw Indians in those days, we loved their, you know, their so-called savage freedom. But we also couldn't let go of the stuff that we got from Europe, you know, civilized order. So we wanted both of those things. And it seems like we had a conflict in trying to decide which one.
Right. And I think that's a conflict that's never been resolved. When we think about the ways that Americans think about their identity in relation to the continent, to the land, to indigenous peoples, you know, there's no resolution there. There's no clarity about that. It's a hard question. In some ways, it's as hard, if not maybe harder in some ways, than the question of slavery, right, which has a certain kind of moral weight to it that oftentimes gets denied or erased when we think about indigenous people and the conquest of the continent. So, you know, for those early settlers, there was a real distinction between this thing I call playing Indian, which is temporary, which is performative, and the other possibility, which is that you would go native. That you would literally cross the line, leave civilization behind, right, and become that other thing, whether you saw it as a sort of, you know, a person of nature in a positive way or whether you saw it as being a savage, right, in a negative way. So Americans not willing to cross that line and, of course, become indigenous, but they also are not willing to stay as British citizens. And so there's a constant kind of play back and forth, desire, repulsion, repulsion, desire. You know, the civilized, the savage, kill the Indian, be the Indian. Be the Indian, kill the Indian, right? So it's completely unresolved, I think.
You talk about how we wanted to we wanted to become Aboriginal. We wanted to become seen as native because we wanted to distinguish ourselves from the British Crown, for example. But we couldn't, as I said, we couldn't finish the deal. We couldn't become native to this land in a real way. We were too connected to the trappings of the old world. And as you put it in the book, we failed to become original and thus finished. And maybe it's too simple-minded to put it this way, but because we couldn't do that, did we become resentful of the Indians who were authentic? And is that in some way one of the reasons we started to annihilate them and displace them?
I mean, it seems like it takes us into the interesting terrain of collective psychology, which is a hard terrain, you know, in some ways to kind of you know, to really, you know, kind of scan and make sense of. But if you sort of name the indigenous or the Aboriginal as a kind of object of desire for yourself, and there is someone who already occupies that position, right? Mm-hmm. There's a fundamental kind of psychological dilemma that you're posed with, that you are not, every Indian person that is there is living evidence that you are not, in fact, what you claim to be, which is indigenous or Aboriginal. And so, you know, I mean, for many people, you know, the whole point of this kind of settler colonialism, as opposed to just regular colonialism, where, hey, let's go in and take the resources and stuff. Mm-hmm. Settler colonialism, no, let's go and we'll take the land. And to take the land, we have to displace people. That's always going to require an erasure to sort of deal with the uneasiness of having, you know, the indigenous sitting right next to you.
Yeah. There's, on one hand, Indianness as a theme, but it's also, I wanted to ask you about this, something you've written about, and that is disguise as an element to all of this. You say these costumes, for example, the you know, Boston colonialists dressing up as Mohawk raiders to, you know, trash Boston Harbor. Part of this was them dressing up in these costumes, and you say costumes have this transformative quality. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
You know, I think the ways that we've thought about it and the ways you and I have just been talking about it have a lot to do with sort of, you know, trying to figure out, well, what are the ideological or the cultural kinds of meanings and underpinnings that people are swapping back and forth with one another? And, you know, that can happen through print, through you know, other kinds of media. But for me, the sort of idea that you would take these ideological things or these cultural things and perform them in disguise, in costume, right, mm-hmm. is actually really, really powerful. The embodiment of ideas, right, in a performance kind of way has everything to do with how one actually constitutes oneself. And you can feel the power of that, you know. It's Halloween and you go out and you're putting on a costume and you're running around and it's night and there's leaves crackling and it's fall. And damn, that's mysterious and it's fun and it's cool. And you look at, I mean, imagine this, that your eyes look out, you see the interior of the mask that you're wearing. And that interior is like that mask is like a mirror. It reflects back on you, right? Yeah. It reflects back and lets you say like, oh, I am this particular person who's wearing a mask, but at the same time, it is completely transparent, right? Your eyes look through the mask and you become, in some ways, the thing that you are performing. And so I think this is a fundamental human kind of, action. I mean, we find performance and disguise and ritual, you know, throughout the world across all times and places. It's something that we just like to do because it's compelling and frankly, it's kind of fun.
Yeah. It's like Comic-Con.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, or it's like reenactment. It's these different kinds of things that allow you to sort of imagine yourself to be a different person and to constitute yourself as the person that you are in relation to that thing. Now, that sounds kind of complicated, but I think we all feel the dynamics of it when we, you know, when we go into these performances.
Yeah. So to be – not to let these guys up in Wellsville off the hook too much, but we could say that in some ways there's a lot more going on than just a bunch of dopey racists insensitively painting themselves in red paint and getting on horses.
I would absolutely say that. It's part of a complicated history of cultural practices that human beings do. And, you know, when you watch the, you know, sort of videos of what's going on there, you know, it's pretty clear that people are having fun, right? There's pleasure that comes out of the experience of, you know, painting your body red and riding around bareback on a horse. Or, I mean, think of the fun stuff, if you want to put it this way. It's fun to ride a horse, right? It's fun to shoot a gun. It's fun to kind of wrestle around, you know, which is the way that Bear River is sort of portrayed as kind of a giant sumo wrestling match, it looks like, you know, in the middle of it. So those things are all fun. Yeah. It's fun to wear different clothes, right? It's fun to have an audience who recognizes you in your different clothes and says, hey, that's, you know, Janie, that's Charlie, right? So there's elements of pleasure, right, that are part of that. And it goes to Comic-Con, it goes to reenactments, it goes to all the ways in which we sort of find ourselves performing, you know, for one another and for ourselves.
But it did make you wince to see it, right?
Yeah, yeah, of course. Right, because it's also performing a certain version of history. And as we narrate history to ourselves and to one another, you know, history is hard. And history is really hard today, right? You know, as a historian, you know, I'm caught constantly by the sort of discourse of relativism. Well, there's a thing called history. The past, it happened. People are willing to accept that. We don't ever actually have access to that past because we didn't live in that past, right? Therefore, everything we do is an interpretation of the past. And in the present moment, the slippage is, and therefore, nothing about history is true. It's only a set of relativistic interpretations which are guided by, you know, what you believe. And you know, that is actually not what history is, right? History means to be as objective a discipline as it can possibly be and to narrate as close to, you know, something like, I hate to say this, right, because this goes to a 19th century sort of, you know, materialist positivist historian, von Ranke, right? But we want to get as close to the past as we can get. And we recognize that we're always going to re-narrate the past, right? The past is not a static thing. We're always going to retell it in ways that speak to the problems of our present. But that's pretty different from speaking to the things that I particularly care about, you know, in a political or social or cultural economic sense, right? So that narration of the past tells a certain story, and in telling that story, it erases a whole bunch of other stories.
Yeah. So there is this, I want to get to this shift that you write about that takes place in the 19th and 20th century, because it turns out we as Americans, we do this a lot. We play Indian a lot, and throughout our history, we keep returning to this, to the Indian, to meet, as you put it in your book, the circumstances of our times. And we can't talk about all of the examples. Before we head to the shift in the 19th and 20th century in the Boy Scouts, which is a really interesting thing to talk about, I did want to ask you, given that we're in Utah, home of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So every year, Latter-day Saints in Utah and in New York, they put on these pageants. And some of the characters are portraying what they believe to be ancient Indians, or as they call them, Lamanites. They're playing Indian, basically. Where does that story fit, do you think? I mean, Joseph Smith, of course, had developed his ideas about religion in the context of a time when there were a lot of myths about, you know, grand ancient Indian civilizations. Where do you figure this fits in all of this?
You know, it's one of the most interesting things that's ever happened in North America, I think, is the founding of the LDS Church. And it comes, I mean, to me, it comes, there's a whole bunch of places where where one can point to, not origins, I think, but beginnings, multiple kinds of beginnings. I mean, it's pretty clear that after the revolution, there's a whole number of people who don't feel like the revolution actually liberated them from anything. And there's a whole series of rebellions after the revolution in which people reenact the revolutionary reenactment of dressing up like Indians. But then there's a moment, right, that comes in the 1820s, 30s, 40s, where the nation is really trying to consolidate itself. And you see fraternal orders and other kinds of instances of people dressing up like Indians, where what's being commemorated is the memory of the revolution and not the possibility of revolution or rebellion. And in that moment, right, Americans try to establish a new kind of separatism from Europe, which is around sort of Americans' distinctive nationalist sort of culture, right? We are these people, and we're not like those people. So you have people like Emerson and James Fenimore Cooper who are trying to create American literatures and make claims about what America is. And you have this moment where people turn to natural wonders, like Niagara Falls, for example, and say, this is bigger and better than the castles you guys have in Europe. And they start imagining nationalist kinds of narratives about ancient America. People get interested in mounds and mound builders. They imagine ancient civilizations. And so in some ways, Joseph Smith is coming completely out of that big, broad American cultural discourse. At the same time, he's coming out of moments of religious and spiritual crisis, right, in North America. And it makes complete sense, right, in that way, that Lamanites would be Indians, right, sort of fallen representations of an older, kind of superior society, right, that once occupied North America, to which then we can claim to be the heirs, right, and the descendants.
Actual heirs.
Yeah.
That's really fascinating. So this shift comes in the 19th and 20th centuries, you write about, and our fascination with playing Indian shifts to this kind of new sensibility where once we were, you say, seeing Native Americans as vicious savages, we started to look at them as having all kinds of these virtues that we could adopt. What happens in the late 19th and early 20th century in the way we're playing Indian then?
Right. Well, this is a moment, I mean, as historians, we like to think about modernity and like, what's the moment of the modern? What's the moment where everything gets kind of weird, and one of the ways I've tried to identify it is something happens in the late 19th and 20th century where the notion and the ways that Americans imagine Indians and engage in this performance actually fundamentally shifts. So if you say that, hey, during the Revolution, Indians are going to be like us, right? We are like Indians. They are like us. There's an environmentalist kind of argument here. Mm-hmm. You know, Indians are free mm-hmm. because they eat free-ranging game, you know, for example. And we are like Indians relative to the British Empire. And so we can imagine all the super positive things about Indians that are really great, and we can internalize them as part of an American identity. And we can kind of tame the idea about an Indian as being savage, not like us. We're not savage, but Indians are savage. And there are moments in the revolution where we say, we will be like Indians. So everything that we learn about the revolutionary sort of Revolutionary War's military tactics, for example, the British march single file in bright red, mm-hmm. you know, uniforms. Well, we, you know, hide behind rocks and trees. This is the sort of savage Indian sort of taking shape as an American kind of claim. Well, in the turn of the 19th and 20th century, I think that gets completely inverted, right? There's a savage Indian that is now out there, but it's the Indian that's been assimilated, right, as the result of a whole series of 19th century policies. That Indian is no longer that different from us. That Indian has become like an American, and what does that mean? It's degraded. That Indian is degraded, right? Alcohol, drunkenness, this is part of the framing of that kind of new Indian savagery in the relation to the modern. And so then we reimagine these Indians who are positive and, you know, they've got a spirituality we don't have, and they're outside a market system, and you know, they're authentic and they're pure. But now we imagine them as being so far away from us that it's hard for us to gain access to them. And that's a moment where Americans are also rethinking what it is, what the trajectory of childhood development is. So in 1904, G. Stanley Hall writes this book called Adolescence, where he basically invents the adolescent. And the argument here is that kids, right, children can actually cross the social, cultural, civilizational boundary and become like Indians, and that they have to do that in order to pass through the stages of social evolution. They have to be little savages before they can be grown-up, civilized people. Hmm.
So you have a section where you write about the Boy Scouts and how Indians were role models in a lot of ways for the Boy Scouts, but also points of entry into these, you know, into magical transfiguring plays, how you put it. But the part that interested me also was girls in scouting, the campfire girls, how the scouting organization used Indian stories to deal with, you know, these complicated changing gender roles. And basically they dressed girls up as Indians in that time, if I understand this right anyway, to keep them from being interested in working outside the home.
Yeah, it's a really interesting kind of practice. I mean, with the Boy Scouts, there's a kind of a duel, right, over which kind of symbolic figure. Will it be a military figure? Lord Robert Baden-Powell started that in mm-hmm. Great Britain. Will it be a pioneer scout? This guy Dan Beard said that. Or will it be an Indian? This guy Ernest Thompson Seton said that. In the end, the sort of scout military model kind of wins out for boys, but for girls, it absolutely doesn't. For girls, the Indian model with campfire girls, started by Luther and Charlotte Gulick, actually wins out. And they say explicitly, right, we will nurture the fire. And then they put a dash and they say, not the wildfire, only the domestic fire. And it's that domestic fire, right, that Indianness represents there. And it has to do with how do you make 30 kinds of soups, and how do you identify the cries of a baby, and why do you sleep with the windows open for, you know, health reasons. And so it's all about domestic training for new kinds of gender, you know, new kinds of gender roles within the household.
Let me ask you about the countercultural new age form of all of this that kicks in the 60s and 70s. On the one hand, you have people at that time playing Indian to, as you put it in your book, to find a reassuring identity in the world that seemed to be out of control. So they connect Indians to environmentalism and spirituality. They were the perfect role models, you say, for protesters in the Vietnam era too. You know, Indians in another era who had protested their persecution. How does it fit in this era?
Well, in some ways, I think that's the kind of the sort of logical development out of this kind of modern moment of Campfire Girls and Boy Scouts and YMCA Indian Guides. And in the 1950s, you get hobbyists who are interested in the precise replication of Indian kinds of things. And by the time you get to the 60s, there's been this accumulation of meanings so that the figure of the Indian can mean all kinds of different things. It becomes very fluid and very fungible. It can be obviously an environmental thing. We see the anti-pollution ad with this guy Iron Eyes Cody crying over seeing pollution, and it's super evocative for people. They get it. They understand what the message is. We see the sort of advent of kind of proto-New Age stuff with sweat lodges where people are trying to get a hold of spirituality through Indian things. We see all kinds of countercultural stuff going on, you know, in San Francisco at the Fillmore, you know, and the Human Bee Inns and all kinds of things that are counterculture. And I think, like, to throw the Vietnam War in there also, right, there's a sort of sense in which people have an awareness in the wake of decolonization movements after World War II, right, and struggles over decolonial kinds of spaces, Indian people, American Indian people, are kind of figuring out that discourse as well. And when people look at Vietnam and see it as a colonial kind of enterprise, they're also able to use Indianness as a way of seeing and making sense of that as well. So there's a moment there, again, where I think Indians have this super evocative kind of thing happening. And, you know, there's Indian politics as well. The seizure of Alcatraz, 1969, Scott Mamede wins the Pulitzer Prize, and all of a sudden people can read Indian fiction. And so there's a bit of an explosion that happens in the late 60s and 70s that carries on and carries forward in attenuated ways into the 80s and 90s and, of course, then into the present.
So where are we today, finally? I mean, the fact that this is going on in Wellsville, in 2017, something like that. Where are we today in the way we're thinking about playing Indian, basically?
Well, I think some of these longstanding kind of practices and traditions, you know, continue to remain salient for people. They continue to create meaning. It's pretty clear, thinking about what happens at Wellsville, that meaning is being created, you know, in exchange. When I watch it,
but Professor, it feels, should they stop it?
Yeah,
do you think?
Yeah, they should stop it, right? I mean, it's to say something is a tradition doesn't, I mean, we change traditions all the time. We invent traditions all the time. Many of the traditions that we think go way, way back, go back 15 years. We have an incredible ability to forget that our traditions are constantly being invented. When I look at that, you know, at Wellsville, I mean, it looks really 1920s-ish to me, and it looks kind of sad, and it's called a sham battle, and it looks like kind of a sham. I mean, and it's sitting there on a baseball field, and it, to me, it feels like if I were doing this, I would be looking in the mirror and asking myself, really? Do I want to be doing this? Am I really getting meanings that I want to get out of this? Am I actually getting meanings, or am I just kind of embarrassed by it? And that's kind of how it feels to me. It seems to me that it's time to invent different kinds of traditions. Towns and places and counties do this all the time.
It's Philip DeLoria. He's a professor of American culture and history at the University of Michigan. He spoke to us from his home in Ann Arbor. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Cass Adair, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.